You've heard our open themes with listeners talking about their vocations.
Missouri dairy farmers, love issues, etc.
And what they're doing while listening to issues, etc.
This is Mark from Michigan, and I am a lawnmower listener. We love issues, etc.
We're looking for more of these elements to include in our open themes. Tell us about your vocation, hobby, or what you do while listening to Issues Etc. Call the Issues Etc. comment line 24/7 at 618-223-8382. If you make a mistake, just start over. 618-223-8382. Thanks for listening, and thanks for contributing to Issues Etc. 618-223-8382.
It has to be very difficult to write a headline nowadays, especially with the changing and we might say ever-changing definition and pronoun schedule that people are expected to keep. The story out of the United Methodist Church of a deacon consecrated, the woman is or identifies as no gender whatsoever, something not between male or female, but neither male nor female. The story is a complicated one in that respect alone, but it's also complicated by the fact that it's hard to write that headline and say the United Methodist Church and have it be accurate. Joining us to talk about media coverage of the ordination of a transgender deacon in the United Methodist Church, Terry Mattingly, Senior Fellow for Media and Religion at the King's College in New York City, author of the weekly On Religion column for the Universal Syndicate and the book Pop Goes Religion, and founder and editor of Get Religion. Terry, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Glad to be here.
I'm having a hard time believing, given the little that I do know, but I'm fairly certain of it, that church law forbids such things in the United Methodist Church, that this deacon, M. Barclay, was actually appointed or ordained by the United Methodist Church. What's the story here?
Well, as the story in the Washington Post makes clear, they was ordained. And this gets us into all kinds of complexities about United Methodist life, which for me stands for a bigger subject on the religion beat, which is the fact that what churches believe often depends on what zip code you're in. And this is a phenomena that affects Methodists, I think, as much or more than anyone else. Either that, or I just simply know more about it since I've been covering this precise story since the early 1980s and have followed a lot of the battles. But let me answer your question directly. At this point in time, the United Methodist Church has no policy on transgender clergy. So there is simply, at this point, a hole in the law. Now, what they do have is a policy of faithfulness in marriage and celibacy and singleness. And the Washington Post story, to its credit, goes into great detail that at this moment in time, this particular non-binary, non-gendered deacon has no love life. They all but say that. They say she or he is not involved in a romantic relationship and thus was not found to be in violation of the faithfulness in marriage, celibacy, and singleness law. Now, in my post at Get Religion, I noted that it never addresses the issue of whether this person believes in the teachings of the church, since he or she has just taken vows to defend them. So we're now into issues about what is church law, how do you enforce church law, and do vows mean anything in a postmodern age where a person, presumably with DNA or they wouldn't exist, can be non-gendered because that is what is in his or her mind. Well, what's the status of the church's doctrines up there at the moment he, she took the vows? It's a fascinating subject, but it does appear that there is no law against transgendered clergy among United Methodists. Now, needless to say, there is a way better chance of such an ordination occurring in San Francisco or Chicago than in Atlanta or Uganda, shall we put it, or Nigeria or anywhere else in the global South, which is the growing sector of United Methodist life. This gets us into the other subject, which is that in United Methodist polity, ordination is pretty much up to the regional jurisdictions. And since the early 80s, I have been covering the fact that different jurisdictions within the United Methodist Church, all the way down to their annual conferences, which are kind of local regions, and then there are larger regions. Just, I know that's hard for people to picture in their minds, but in the United States, the big jurisdictions are Western, North Central, South Central, Northeastern, and Southeastern in the United Methodist Church. This ordination took place in the North Central region, which is primarily the liberal upper Midwest. This is a rapidly declining sector of the United Methodist Church, but it is larger than the Western jurisdiction, far and away the smallest United Methodist jurisdiction, which has previously made most of the news when it comes to sexuality, and that I was covering all the way back in the early 80s, when the Bishop of Denver declared, frankly, "I don't believe my church's teachings on homosexuality or sex outside of marriage, and thus I'm going to ordain an openly gay man," who refused to answer any questions at all about his sex life. Or at least he refused to answer them whenever the question was asked by Methodists. He was extremely candid when asked by the press or anybody else. So this is an old story. I mean, do the math. 1981, 1982. How old were you then?
1982, I was 18 years old.
Okay, well, I imagine a lot of listeners can do the math there on their own ages. I had just moved to Denver, Colorado, as a religion reporter, and it was in my early 30s when I started covering this story, and I'm now 63. So once again, this has been around for multiple decades. And this same loophole in United Methodist polity continues to be at the root of all of these stories, which is the jurisdictions do the ordaining. Once they've ordained someone, that person is in valid orders, even though it's inaccurate to say they were ordained by the entire United Methodist Church, as if the United Methodist Church had approved that ordination. What happened, kind of like in real estate, is location, location, location. What works in Denver doesn't represent the whole church, but it's valid unless the whole church then votes to declare it invalid. And that's where the United Methodists have never really succeeded in taking action to defend their own doctrines. Now, at the same time, they haven't changed their doctrines. They've stated over and over and over what the church believes on sexuality and continue to restate traditional basic Christian teachings on this subject. The jurisdictions, the leaders of the jurisdictions, and frankly, a lot of their ecclesiastical bureaucrats and maybe seminary professors, at best, are affirming those teachings with their fingers crossed.
Okay, a couple issues here. Obviously, this is a story that would require nuance, somewhat sophisticated understanding of the United Methodist Church and its law and its system
yep.
of polity. And it's going to require that, well, let's deal with the basic grammar first. It's going to require that the story be written with the proper pronouns. You've already stumbled over it. I, as a matter of principle, refer to people by the pronouns.
By their DNA, yeah.
Yeah, by their DNA pronouns as a matter of principle. Of course, I'm not a journalist either. Can you talk briefly about the quandary that a journalist may find themselves in when someone, in this case, M. Barclay, insists on being referred to by the pronoun they, rather than he or she in the third person. What a journalist is to do here.
Well, I kind of, with tongue slightly in cheek, left that subject aside in my post, with the possible exception of one sentence, which several readers, you know, let me know they noted. I did write a sentence that said, as you would expect, the Post story does a great job of telling M. Barclay's story from M. Barclay's point of view and that of M. Barclay's supporters. In other words, I just left the pronoun completely out by repeating the person's name over and over and over. That, frankly, is an option. I'll never forget years ago when I wrote a story about some deaths in a family back early in the AIDS era, in which I was writing a story under Associated Press style, obviously, in which I had six family members in the same story, all with the same last name, which put me in, you know, a tremendously difficult situation under AP style, where you identify people by their last name. You know, I had to go with the younger, the older, and then I had to use pronouns wherever possible. And on one or two occasions, just to be clear, I had to use someone's whole name just to make sure that people understood. I think journalists in this case, I would argue that they need to err on the side of clarity to the reader. And in this case, rather than the awkward situation of singular they, if pressed on this, if I was still in a hard news position, I think I would go for he, she, before I would do a plural singular. You know, they is. You know, I mean, I don't think anybody's saying that we're actually dealing with multiple personality possession or anything here.
Well, let me play devil's advocate for a moment, because someone, I can see an editor, I can imagine, and I don't think I am out of the realm of possibility in imagining an editor saying, you can't use he/she because that is binary. And the presuppositions of M. Barclay is that she is neither, therefore she can't be kind of that binary he/she.
Or, I mean, I don't fully understand what's really even being claimed here, whether we're talking about essentially a gay person who wants to be bisexual in conduct or something. But clearly this is very much like the whole gender debate. The overarching principle here is that a person is whoever that person claims to be, even at any particular moment in time. And there's a whole, you know, you got the LGBTQIA. I mean, you've got the long list of initials now growing in the sexuality gender catch logo, so to speak. You know, I would be the first to admit I don't understand it all. I do know that when you write a sentence, you need to communicate things in words that readers will have a chance to understand. And in this case, maybe the only solution is to avoid pronouns altogether.
Terry Mattingly is our guest. We're talking about media coverage of the ordination of a transgender deacon in the United Methodist Church. When we come back, given the presupposition that you are whatever you think you are at the moment, does the United Methodist Church know who they've actually appointed to be deacon?
Have you been too busy to get your associate's, bachelor's, or master's degree? Concordia University, Wisconsin offers 50 online educational options. Find out more at issuesetc.org. Click the Concordia University online logo and enter the program code ISSUES to waive your application fee. Concordia University, Wisconsin is here to strengthen and support the church. Lifelong Lutheran learning. issuesetc.org and click Concordia University, Wisconsin online.
I've got some friends down in Houston.
Join Mark and Molly Hemingway, Brian Wolfmiller, Rod Dreher, Jennifer Roback Morse, Scott Murray, and me for the 2017 Fall Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, Friday, November 10th and Saturday, November 11th in Houston, Texas. Registration is $120. For more information, visit issuesetc.org. The Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, November 10th and 11th in Houston.
And they won't ask me questions.
Yes, there is a Messiah in Seattle. Messiah Lutheran Church and Concordia Lutheran School have served North Seattle for over 60 years, and we invite you to join us on Sunday mornings at 8 and 10:45 with Bible study at 9:20. Messiah Seattle is proud to support Issues Etc. To learn more, watch our adult information class videos online or on DVD. Our website is messiahseattle.org, 206-524-0024.
Did you know that Luther Academy has been providing continuing education for confessional Lutheran pastors and lay people worldwide for more than 20 years? Luther Academy promotes confessional Lutheran theology through conferences, scholarly exchanges, and publications like Logia, the Confessional Lutheran Dogmatic Series, and Luther Digest. Find out more about Luther Academy and sign up for their free email newsletter at lutheracademy.com. lutheracademy.com.
Listen to what you want, when you want. You're listening to Issues Etc.
The Church's Music from the 20th Century. The 17th Century. The 11th Century. The 8th century. The 4th century. The best of the church's music from the past 2,000 years. LutheranPublicRadio.org.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. on this Wednesday afternoon, the 14th of June. Terry Mattingly is our guest. We're talking about media coverage of the ordination of a transgender deacon in the United Methodist Church. He's author of the weekly On Religion column for the Universal Syndicate. Terry, you mentioned before the presupposition that is at work now in culture, socially, with respect to gender fluidity, that a person is whatever they identify as at that particular moment. And I'm wondering if that raises an additional question here about this appointment of a deacon in the United Methodist Church. Does the United Methodist Church, or at least this regional jurisdiction of the church, do they know who they've appointed deacon, given the fact that she could change her mind any minute?
Well, there you went again with the pronoun. But see, clearly the Northern Central Jurisdiction of the United Methodist Church has said, we are comfortable with this person's beliefs. And at that point, since we're dealing with at the level of religious belief, you know, I've heard some people say that people have a right to declare their own gender and whatever as a matter of their religious liberty to be perceived as the soul they are saying they are. I mean, this opens all kinds of doors. My point in the story, and here in what I hope we're talking about today, this affects Methodists. What people, I think, really need to understand is the degree that this affects other churches as well. If you have followed debates, even, say, among Southern Baptists for decades, you'd have to be crazy not to note that it matters what zip code you're in when it comes to what Southern Baptists believe. And occasionally, a local Baptist association will disenfranchise an individual congregation because with their congregational freedom and soul competency, they have taken some action with which they disagree. But the simple fact, even within a state like Texas, which I know so well, Southern Baptist life in Austin is not the same as Southern Baptist life in rural or small town Texas. The more Baptist you have in a zip code, the more likely you are to find people of varying beliefs And those beliefs are often determined by how far you are from a university campus or kind of the general cultural makeup of wherever you are in terms of city or town. Now, this would even affect, I've watched Mormon debates in recent years, and you'd be crazy not to note that there are geographical patterns. In the Roman Catholic Church right now, we actually have in a recent papal document on the subject of divorce and the receiving of communion for Catholics who have been divorced but then have not received permission from the church to move on from that and to have that previous marriage nullified. We actually are now beginning to see indications from this particular pope, Pope Francis, that he's comfortable with saying that bishops in Argentina may take a completely different stance on this than bishops in Nigeria versus bishops in Germany versus bishops in Texas, to where they need a kind of zip code regional freedom to adapt doctrine to their own local circumstances, to where the Roman Catholic Church, which to me is kind of the epitome of an ecclesiastical institution that strives for legal and doctrinal consistency, we literally could have the Roman Catholic Church opening itself up on some doctrinal issues to the kind of multi-jurisdictional haziness and fogginess that we see in this United Methodist decision. And I predict that when that happens, what's already happening will get even louder. You'll have conservative Catholics in a certain part of the world saying, wait a minute, this is what our church has taught for centuries. This is what the Bible states. How can we change that? And someone will say, no, we're not changing it. We're just taking some pastoral flexibility. And I would argue that this is all essentially about where people live, the cultures they're in, and that this is a factor in religion news that reporters simply have to start wising up on and covering it. So when the Washington Post prints a headline that says the United Methodist Church has appointed a transgender deacon, some editor somewhere has to be able to say that's simply factually inaccurate. If we're going to actually tell readers what happened, you'd have to say something like United Methodists in American Northeast or United Methodist in urban Chicago or United Methodist in, you're going to have some qualifier that lets the reader know an entire ecclesiastical body has not managed to agree on this sort of issue. Otherwise, we're just confusing people.
With respect to church law, and Methodists are speak of church law. That's how they describe their both their polity, and I think it overlaps with their doctrinal statements as well.
It's the book of discipline is a book both of doctrine and kind of ruling guidelines for community life. Yeah, it's both.
Is there a follow-up story here, not only with the United Methodist Church, but with other churches, where obviously I've spoken recently with Mark Tooley, who's concerned about this, writing for the Institute on Religion and Democracy about this situation with M. Barclay. And he said, well, I was warning about this and submitting overtures to my regional jurisdiction 10 years ago, and no one took me seriously. And perhaps they will take those overtures seriously now. How do you follow up in a story saying, what is the United Methodist Church, that is the larger organization, which is, by the way, a multinational church?
Yes.
What are they going to do to be proactive in church law to deal with incidents like this?
Well, I'm sure that someone now is going to come forward with some kind of a statement for the discipline related to gender. I can imagine that will come up. But if I was a reporter and I was at a large paper that wanted to focus, or a wire service that wanted to focus on this, I would immediately contact the ordination councils of the other jurisdictions, at the very least in the United States, and say, what are you articulating at your level about the role of gender since law doesn't address it? Since you lack church law, what is the actual policy on the ground in the massive southeastern U.S. jurisdiction? What's the policy in San Francisco? What's the policy in Denver? Normally, what happens in liberal mainline Protestantism is activists on the left act now and argue later. I mean, you saw this years ago, decades ago, with the ordination of women in the Episcopal Church, where a couple of bishops, without the permission of their church, just consecrated some priests and, in effect, said, we disagree with the teachings of our church, but we're bishops. We have the right to ordain who we want to ordain. We do this. And then the whole church gets caught in a rear guard action, trying to define, often in the light of withering mainstream press coverage, declaring them attempting to stomp down this new uprising of doctrinal and soul freedom, or words to that effect. And the church gets caught coming from behind. In this case, United Methodist Polity allows this. And I'm trying to imagine the United Methodist Church trying to set up a global council governing ordination. I don't think they could possibly do that. It would be too big a task. And of course, you also have the irony of this whole situation, which was, you know, John Wesley. The Methodism movement begins both with his tremendous emphasis on piety and Bible study and small groups and all this other stuff, but also with John Wesley bumping up against the Anglican Church in England over issues of, well, why can't I ordain people? Why can't we ordain who we want to ordain, even if they're a little bit too conservative for you? So the freedom of Wesley, which was claimed as a part of kind of an evangelical revival within Anglicanism, the freedom of Wesley in this day and age turns out to help the left. It's a fascinating and deep subject, and one that deserves, reporters just need to sweat the details on this kind of stuff.
Well, among those details, the United Methodist Church has a news center at its website. Is that a place to go and see if there could be some clarification from the national organization? We'll get Terry's answer to that question right after this. Jesus the good teacher, Jesus the therapist, Jesus the giver of bling. The Issues Etc. book of the month for June is Will the Real Jesus Please Stand Up? 12 False Christs. It's written by regular guest Dr. Matt Richard. Read an excerpt at issuesetc.org or purchase Will the Real Jesus Please Stand Up? By calling Concordia Publishing House 1-800-325-3040. The Issues Etc. book of the month, Will the Real Jesus Please Stand Up?
If you've ever attended an Issues Etc. conference or any number of events that take place across the Synod and have wondered why more people from my congregation aren't here, check out the special seminar package the CLCC is offering for the 500th anniversary. All you need so the pastors of your circuit can organize, promote, and present a seminar that appeals to the members of your congregation, even the youth, is provided free by the CLCC. Just go to theclcc.org and click on the blue box, or check us out on Facebook.
Smartest listeners in radio, you're listening to Issues Etc.
It is the greatest adventure you could ever possibly imagine. It's demanding, it's hard, it's challenging, and what a blessing it is.
Dr. Larry Rast, president of Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana, on why a man should consider the vocation of pastor.
And it is an incredible blessing to be honored with the opportunity to work with these incredible young men and older men as well, who are committing themselves to the proclamation of God's word, the right distinction of law and gospel, and to take the good news of Jesus Christ into all the world.
You can find out more about studying for the pastoral ministry at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, at ctsfw.edu or call 1-800-481-2155. Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, forming servants in Jesus Christ who teach the faithful, reach the lost, and care for all. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Terry Mattingly is our guest, Senior Fellow for Media and Religion at the King's College in New York City and author of the weekly On Religion column for the Universal Syndicate, the book Pop Goes Religion, and founder and editor of Get Religion. We're talking about media coverage of the ordination of a transgender deacon in the United Methodist Church. Terry, you talked about the reporters doing the basic groundwork that needs to be done. Is part of that, given the fact that the United Methodist Church is a multinational church organization, it has a news center, is that an appropriate place to go to the national organization seeking clarification on situations like that of M. Barclay?
You could, but I don't think settling for PR statements is a sign of journalism commitment on these things. All of these jurisdictions have their main offices online. It would take maybe 10 minutes to find out some contacts at the jurisdictional level in other parts of the country and to start placing some telephone calls. In the age of the internet, that kind of information is infinitely more accessible. The problem, again, and one that we discuss so often, is that you have to know what you don't know, or you have to know that a subject exists in order to pursue it. So you have an activist for M. Barclay and M. Barclay's supporters on the telephone talking to you, and they're telling you that, yes, this is perfectly legal, yes, the Northern, and this means it stands for the whole church. And you're going, well, okay. Especially if you're inclined to believe what they're saying because you support that particular issue. But if you don't have any experience covering United Methodist, whether you're liberal, conservative, whatever, you don't know that there are questions to ask. You don't know that there have been papers dating all the way back to a wonderful document, which I wish was online. I still have a hard copy from the 80s called The Seven Churches of United Methodism. And it was written in part by a famous author, William Willimon, who at that time was on the faculty at Duke and is now a United Methodist bishop. I don't know if he's retired or not at this stage, but along with a sociologist, they produced this document in the 80s, I stress, in the 80s, which basically said that United Methodists living in seven different regions essentially went to different schools, believed different things, and in some cases could literally be stated as worshiping different gods in terms of how they defined certain elements of Christology. In some cases, I would say neo-paganism, you know, or whatever. I mean, you had certain trends in the New Age movement and stuff that affected. I covered an Episcopal church service back in the early 90s, you know, where they sang praises to Ra and Ashra, the gods of Egypt, and, you know, and prayed in the name of African deities from a pantheistic order. And the preacher in the service was Carl Sagan, the late Carl Sagan. Now, would you say that that's more likely to happen in a cathedral in New York City than Dallas?
Probably 5 times more likely, yes.
More like 100 times more likely. But yeah, we can argue percentages later. But my point here is location, location, location is something that we have to write into our stories so that readers know that it's not an entire religious body who has reclaimed this. I mean, you can make a story sound bigger than it is. The M. Barclay story is important, but it's just the opening act of what I predict will be a long, long drama. Will readers have a chance to read about all those other acts, or from the viewpoint of the Washington Post story, is this essentially over?
Is a more general and bigger story also, and you hinted at this at the beginning of our conversation, someone actually sitting down and saying, let's go perhaps denomination by denomination. What does the Episcopal Church look like in New York City? What does it look like in Omaha? Doing that compare and contrast, what does the Southern Baptist Church look like in, say, Los Angeles? What does it look like in Oklahoma City? Mm-hmm. Talking about those regional differences where you might even be, as you said before, in some cases, talking about essentially different churches under one umbrella.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I can think of hundreds of story angles. Why does this Catholic college produce 10, 15 priests every year, and this Catholic college hasn't produced one in a decade? Why does this Southern Baptist Church give X amount of money to foreign missions and this other one doesn't? Why are Catholic schools closing in certain parts of the church and they can't build them fast enough in others? You've heard the old statement that demographics is destiny. I would say that doctrine is destiny. And then you add a third layer, which is sometimes zip code is destiny on some of these issues. There, you literally, almost every single major story that comes up gets affected by these factors to some degree, whether it's just simply matters of where churches are growing and where they're shrinking. Where are there more nuns, the religiously unaffiliated, not the N-U-N-S of the previous example? Why are there more nuns in the Pacific Northwest than there are in Texas? Why are the big story you've heard me talk about over and over, why are people lining up to go to confession in certain parishes or in certain dioceses, and yet in other dioceses, the priest maybe hears a couple of confessions a week by appointment, and other than that, that crucial Catholic sacrament has vanished. It's a matter of location, and it's a matter of the functioning religious doctrines in those different locations. And like I said, it's a factor that affects way more stories than we want to admit or that we take the time and trouble to explain to readers.
Terry Mattingly, Senior Fellow for Media and Religion at the King's College in New York City and author of the weekly On Religion column for the Universal Syndicate and the book Pop Goes Religion. He's founder and editor of Get Religion. Terry, thank you for being our guest.
Glad to be here again.
Folks, the Lutheran Federal Credit Union is dedicated to serving the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod community through checking and savings accounts, through credit cards, home loans, car loans, and more. Learn more at LutheranFCU.org. That's LutheranFCU.org. In Hour 2 of Issues, Etc., a pastoral perspective on the Alexandria shooting this morning. Pastor Christopher Eskett of Emmanuel Lutheran Church in Alexandria, Virginia, will be our guest. We'll talk with Dr. Kevin Golden, pastor of Village Lutheran Church in Ladue, about Elisha the prophet that the church remembers on this day, June the 14th. And then Dr. Jennifer Roback Morris will join us. She's written recently about what she calls divorce enablers. We'll have a conversation with her on what makes the perfect storm for divorce and continues to empower the divorce industry. I'm Todd Wilkin. Hour 2 of Issues, Etc. in 5 minutes.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.
Hello, this is Pastor Kevin Golden of Village Lutheran Church in Ladue, Missouri. The saints at Village Lutheran are proud to be part of the Issues Etc. 300, sharing in their Christ-centered, cross-focused proclamation of the gospel. If you find yourself in St. Louis, join us on Sundays at 8:15 and 10:45 for the Divine Service, 9:30 for Bible study and Sunday school, as we receive Christ's gifts of forgiveness, life, and salvation. Or visit us on the web at www.villagelutheranchurch.org.
We know that you want to build your family on the right foundation from the very start, the foundation of Jesus Christ. Concordia Publishing House offers more than 8,000 products for churches, schools, and homes, dedicated customer service, and an experienced staff to help you focus on what matters most. Click to connect at cph.org. Concordia Publishing House, listening, responding, providing for God's people. Concordia Publishing House, cph.org.